Hare Krishna. Today morning we are discussing on the topic of appreciating the Srimad Bhagavatam as a Rasa Shastra. So I will talk this topic in four parts. First, I will talk about the overall theme of the Bhagavatam and its relationship with Rasa. Then secondly, I will talk about the Rasa tradition which was there in India and how it developed. Third, I will talk about how Rupa Goswami integrated the Rasa tradition with the Bhakti tradition. And fourthly, I talk about how Rupa Goswami and Jiva Goswami have re-envisioned the Bhagavatam as a Rasa literature in terms of the contemporary Rasa theory at that time. So firstly, Srimad Bhagavatam is akin to a conceptual autobiography of Shukadeva Goswami. Now, normally an autobiography is a narrative of events. This happened, this happened, this happened. But a conceptual autobiography is a special genre in autobiography where the focus is not on the events that happen in the person's life, but it is on the conceptual development of that person. So, for example, what was the person's thinking earlier and how that thinking changed and what were the factors that caused that change? That's a conceptual autobiography. Now, all autobiographies have a conceptual dimension to them. Ultimately, the story of life involves the story of a person's thinking. But a conceptual autobiography is something that doesn't focus on the person as much as it focuses on the thought systems. So this, we know Shukadeva Goswami was an impersonalist and he became a personalist. So in one sense, that theme is encapsulated in the first three introductory verses of the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam begins 1.1.1 with Dhimani. So now the first verse, Janmadyasyataha, itself is such a concept-rich verse that there are scholars in the tradition. There is, for example, Madhusudana Saraswati. He wrote a full book on Srimad Bhagavatam Prathama Shloka Tatpari. A commentary of just the first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's a very concept-laden verse. And the significant thing is Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya in the first verse is actually invocation. It is not directly a part of the verse. So the first verse is non-sectarian in its depiction, its definition of the absolute truth. It does not mention any specific deity. This is that absolute truth is the source of everything and everywhere. And the source who is the one by whom this false world appears real, by whom even those who are virtuous are put into illusion. Like that he goes on in describing. And it concludes with Dhimani. Dhimani is meditate. Now meditation can be personal or impersonal. Dhimani, the word, is most famously associated with the Gayatri Mantra. And usually when the Gayatri Mantra is chanted, there is not much of a clear conception of who it is that is being worshipped. Although the Gayatri Mantra is not like a Karmakanda Mantra where people are concerned only with what material fruits I can get. It is more concerned with, please illumine me, guide me in the path of knowledge. Please illumine me with knowledge. But still, some people think that Gayatri refers to Gayatri Devi, some people think it refers to Surya. Different people have different ideas of what it refers to. So Dhimani, there the mood is not exactly personal. Although it can be personal if a person with a personal conception does the meditation. But Dhimani, the whole first verse, is non-specific about the description about who is being invoked. So Dhimani is more like a passive meditation that will be at best in Shantaras. It can be impersonal meditation or it can be Shantaras meditation. How great is that absolute truth? Meditator. As the Bhagavatam moves forward to this third verse is talking about Pipatta. It is not Dhimani, it is Pipatta, drink. It is not just meditate, it is drink and relish. Rasamalayam. drink and relish rasika. Be a relisher of rasika. So here the Bhagavatam is moving very explicitly towards a relishable conception of the absolute truth. And as the Bhagavatam will reveal, that conception is the personal conception. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, out of 335 chapters, 90 chapters are the 10th canto. And not only that, if you look at the second longest canto, the third and the 11th cantos are more or less close second. But even if you see, the 11th canto is also about Krishna. 35 chapters. These are Krishna's actions or Krishna's instructions. A major part is Krishna's instructions of the Gita, almost 24 chapters. So, out of the 335 chapters of the Srimad Bhagavatam, 125, which is more than one third, are directly dealing with Krishna. And Krishna is Rasaraj. And if you see, Krishna is the only Devata, form of the Absolute Truth, who is practically referred to in each canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, the Bhagavatam is clearly focused on Krishna. So, the rasa, the source of rasa, the Bhagavatam indicates, is Krishna. And the way the Shukdeva Goswami develops the Srimad Bhagavatam, Shukdeva Goswami actually starts speaking from the second canto. The first canto is basically setting the scene. And the second, setting the scene, that means in the first canto, this is a whole different subject. There is firstly the evolution of the Srimad Bhagavatam in terms of Narad Muni's instructing Vyasadeva. That comes in the 4th, 5th, 6th chapters. And from the 7th chapter onwards, 7th chapter on first 15 verses describe how Shukdeva Goswami became qualified to teach Srimad Bhagavatam. And then from that point onwards till the end of the 19th chapter, it is all describing, setting the scene for how Parikshit Maharaj became ready to hear the Srimad Bhagavatam. So, the first canto is essentially setting the scene. And the second canto is where the Bhagavatam begins. And there are different conceptions of the Absolute Truth are talked about. For example, the universal form. Then, the Bhagavatam talks about envisioning God through matter in three ways. One is the Virata Rupa in the second canto, then it talks about the Sankhya in the third canto in terms of analysis of material elements, and fifth canto it talks about the cosmology. And throughout the focus is on the development of the conception of God. And we see there are more and more personal conceptions of God from Varaha, who comes in the initial cantos, as we move towards Vamana, to Rakthula, to Narasimha, to Ram, and ultimately to Krishna. So in this way, इस लेक्चर का हिंदी अनुवाद परिक्रमा मार्ग में हो रहा है. So the Bhagavatam moves towards the 10th canto gradually. Now Srila Prabhupada names his cantos not so much based on the content of the Bhagavatam. He names them not based on the content of the specific canto of the Bhagavatam. He names them based on the 10 subjects of the Bhagavatam. Satra Sargo Visargascha Sthanam Poshanam Mutaya. What is talked about in 2.10.1, the 10 subjects of Srimad Bhagavatam. So Srila Prabhupada correlates that with each canto. So there need not be any direct description of creation in the first canto. But that is the first theme of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So Prabhupada names that as the first canto. And Jiva Goswami explains in the Bhagavad Sandarbha that actually all these subjects are talked about in all the cantos. Not in some cantos there may be more, some cantos may be less. But all of them are talked about. And last two cantos Prabhupada names based on the broad content. General history is the 11th canto. And 12th canto is the age of deterioration. General history is that Krishna, when he is speaking to Uddhava, he is quoting many historical references. He is talking about Pingala, he is talking about Avadhut Brahmana, he is talking about Krishna the Hamsa avatar instructing the Kumaras. Like that, he tells many anecdotes, so that's general history. And 12th canto is about Kali Yuga. So essentially, the Bhagavatam is centered on the 10th and 11th cantos, and even then among the 10th cantos. And that is where the concept of rasa, in terms of relishing the beauty and the sweetness of the Absolute Truth, is most vividly depicted.
So I'll come back to this theme of the 10th canto later. Now let's go to the rasa tradition. See, often, although we are personalists, we have sometimes a very impersonal conception of Indian history. What do you mean by impersonal conception? Not that we think that Indian history is filled with impersonalists, but that, you know, in the past everyone was a devotee all the time. It is not like that. Among all the classical languages, classical means Greek, Latin, among all the classical languages that were there, between roughly like 5th century BC to 5th century AD, the maximum atheistic literature are found in Sanskrit. Why? Because India was ruled by atheistic doctrines. You know, from roughly 5th century BC when Buddha appeared, at the same time Mahavir Jain appeared. Buddhism and Jainism were both atheistic. And they ruled India. Initially, they taught in Prakrit, the local languages. But as they gained more and more followers, in order to gain respectability, they started writing in Sanskrit also. Nagarjuna was a very prominent Sanskrit scholar. And he was a very prominent Buddhist teacher. So Shankaracharya took the thought system from Nagarjuna. And he showed how that same thought system, Nagarjuna used to talk about a two-level reality. And Shankaracharya said how that was two-level reality is there in the Vedas also, in the Upanishads primarily. So the point I'm making is that it was not that in India everyone was a devotee. The point is that whenever there is a path of dharma, there is always going to be adharma also. There are always going to be people who have different varieties of desires. And accordingly, they will develop different thought systems. So, the rasa tradition was there for a long, long time, but it became very prominent around 14th, 15th, 16th centuries, about the time when Gaudiya Vaishnavism manifested. So, what is the rasa tradition exactly? The primary book is Bharat Muni's Natya Shastra. So, Natya Shastra is a book which describes how the devtas at one time went to Brahmaji and they asked Brahma that we want a form of entertainment that will be both visual, sonic as well as action filled. And that time Brahmaji instructed them in Natya Shastra and how to call it dramaturgy. Drama is actually doing drama. Dramaturgy is the study, systematic study of dramas. So then that concept was developed by various thinkers, Anandavardhan and others. And then there was one Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, who is the Vaishnavacharya. Before that, there was another Vishwanath who wrote a commentary on the Natya Shastra. Now, in Natya Shastra, the idea is that if there is a Rasika audience, then Rasika means an audience that is refined, audience that has some culture, some conceptual appreciation, then certain stimuli can evoke certain emotions in that audience. So the whole point of drama is to evoke rasa in the audience. So originally, as Natya Shastra describes it, rasa was a concept that was primarily meant for dramas. It, as it is described in Natya Shastra, it had nothing to do with bhakti. It was primarily a concept that in dramas, people, how they can evoke certain emotions. And that was a hugely developed field. And around 14th, 15th centuries, that subject became very, very popular. That whole idea of drama. So everybody who is an intellectual, just like today, say science may have respectability. Say somebody is a scientist, then people will respect that person. So similarly, at that time, if anybody was a learner in Natya Shastra, if anybody who wanted to gain respectability for that message, if they could present it through the means of Natya Shastra, then they would get a lot of respectability. So this was not the case at the time of the previous Vaishnavacharyas. For example, Ramanuja or Madhva. Rasa Shastra was there, the Rasa tradition was there, but it had not become as influential as it had become at the time of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his followers, primarily Rupa Goswami and Jiva Goswami, among others also, they decided to use the popularity of the rasa tradition and present bhakti in those means. So what has Rupa Goswami done in Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu? He has taken the overall structure that is developed in the rasa tradition, but he has transposed it from drama, which is meant basically for evoking emotions in relationship with non-historical characters. The characters in the drama might often be imaginary. He's transposed that from drama to real life and in relationship with the Supreme Lord. So what does this mean? I'll just explain some concepts from the dramaturgy, and then I'll show how Rupa Goswami has applied it to bhakti. So we hear these terms in Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu. We have Anubhav, Vibhav, Vyabhachari Bhav, Sthayi Bhav. We are all this bhav and we don't get any bhav.
We wonder what is all this going on, these terms. They seem very confusing.
So, see, every field, as it develops, you know, it's natural that it becomes more and more technically specialized. And as it becomes more and more technically specialized, that technical specialization can be because of many purposes. One purpose is that as the field has become more specialized, then there has to be more and more precise understanding and communication. Just like when one doctor talks with another and one doctor talks with the patient, the kind of terminology, the kind of concept they will discuss will be different. So these terms, Anubhav, Vibhav, Vyabhichari Bhav, they are actually technical terms which are developed in rasa tradition. So if you go back to the original Bharatmuni Natya Shastra, the terms he uses there are very simple. So I will use those terms and then I will link with them with this term. So he basically talks that in a drama there are three main things. There is Karana, Karya and Sahakarya. So for example, there is a comedy. I'll take a secular example, then I'll come to a devotional example. So there is a comedy. So in the comedy, the Karana is the setting. So normally, if you want to do a comedy, you cannot do in a graveyard. That setting will be inappropriate. So there is a particular setting, or suppose there is somebody who wants to show romance. There, you may show green, they may show forest, you may show rains, you may show beautiful weather, maybe some peacocks and peahen dancing together. So all this is the karana, it is the environment, the setting. Then there is a karya. The karya is the action that is done. So in a comedy, a person might make a joke. In a romance, the hero and heroine might dance together, whatever. So, and then sahakari is the assisting emotions. The assisting emotions. I'll come to sahakari a little later. Now going back to karya. In karya, karya is the environment. In the environment, there are two aspects to it. There is the inactive setting, and there are the active players. Now, when I'm in the karana, see, karya is what the players do. Karana is what is present. So in what is present, there will be the setting in terms of the background environment, and then there will be the players, there will be the characters who are there. So, for example, if somebody, there is a comedy. Now in some comedies, there is a person who looks like a little bit like a clown. So that person will be the what? Karya. So now these two things, the environment and the character. So the character is called the alamban, and the environment is called as the uddipan. The alamban and the uddipan. So for example, now there is a clown like character. He's the alamban. And when he speaks when he speaks something which is like a joke, then sometimes in many comedy shows, they have a background where people are laughing. So that is the uddipan. So sangha sanjayate kama. So when we hear people laughing, we know, why should I miss the joke? Let me also laugh. So there is the alamban and there is the uddipan. So now I'll go back again. There is karya, karana, sahakari. So karya is what the action is. So for example, the cracking of a joke.
The Karana is the person who is going to crack the joke. And then whatever setting is there, whatever passive setting is there, that is the Alamba and the Uttipa. So now, coming to Rupa Goswami's terminology, Rupa Goswami, he uses the existing terminology at that time. So Vibhava is the Karana. Anubhav is the Karana. Sahakari is the Vyabhichari Bhav. So, Vibhava has two characters, two parts to it. Vibhava has Alamban and Uddipan. I think this is becoming a little technical. So, let me make things a little simpler now. Let's bring it to Krishna Lila. So, for example, when Krishna is going to steal butter. So, now if the butter is kept in a public place where anybody can see and anybody can catch, then that Karana is not suitable. So the butter is kept in a dark place where it is locked and Krishna and his friends have some fun, finding some way to break into it. And they are all like, shh, shh, don't make any noise. And they are making more noise by that itself. So all that is creating the setting. So Krishna and his Gopas, they are the Alamban. They are the players over there. And then maybe Yashoda Mai suspected, where is Krishna gone? And she is searching. And other Gopis are searching. So they are also part of the Alamban. Now Krishna goes inside. Let's take a most specific, let's take Damodara. So Yashoda Mai and Krishna, Krishna is drinking milk from Yashoda Mai's breast. And then because of the milk boiling over, Yashoda Mai puts Krishna aside and goes, Krishna becomes angry. And then he thinks, I want to do some mischief. He breaks the water pot, the pot that is there, and he goes further, he goes to see what else he can do. So he goes and sees where the things are stored. Now when he goes over there, that is a place which is different from where Mother Yashoda was. It's a different room. And he goes inside there, and along with him, monkeys also appear over there. So as he breaks the pot, he gives it all to the monkeys. So this setting. So Krishna's climbing on a ukhala. And then Krishna's beckoning the monkeys and feeding the monkeys. All this is a part of that which is creating the emotion. So when Yashoda Mai comes along, Yashoda Mai comes on tiptoe. Where is Krishna? She sees Krishna. And she wants to catch Krishna red-handed. She's not red-handed, white-handed.
So she wants to catch him with butter in his hand. He comes sneakily behind.
And Krishna doesn't see. So Krishna, what happens is the monkeys ahead of him see. And when the monkeys see that, they just get shocked. Oh, Yashoda is coming. Krishna is in trouble now. We should not be in trouble. We'll run away. And they start running away, and Krishna understands something is wrong. And turns around and sees Yashoda Mai. That time, all the enjoyment that he is getting is transformed to terror. He jumps off and starts running away from there. So, now all these actions which Krishna does, so these invoke, so there is an interplay of emotion between Krishna and Yashoda Mai. And these emotions comprise rasa. So, Rupa Goswami explains that there is an eternal level of reality where Krishna's pastimes are happening. And that also happens here in this world when he descends. Now we as sadhakas want to experience spiritual emotions. The path of bhakti, its speciality is that it makes emotions into pathways to the divine. If you see the impersonal path, it says emotions are the obstacle to the divine. Give up emotions. Then you will be able to attain the spiritual level of reality. But bhakti says emotions are the path to the divine. But what kind of emotions? Not all emotions. We have to choose refined emotions. Just like I was giving the example of Rasika. Now for example, say a Bharatanatyam dance is being performed. And say a very skilled female dancer is performing a particular dance. Maybe she is Yashoda Mai and there is Krishna. And there is stealing butter going on.
Now, if a person has an understanding of Bharatanatyam, has an understanding of Krishna Leela, then that person can appreciate how beautifully that pastime is being acted. But if a person is not rasika, then all that, if there's a male audience, all that the male audience sees is that the female. And they see the female's body and all that they get over there is lust. So, the point is that rasika, if rasa is to be experienced, the audience has to be rasika. So, unless the consciousness is cultivated properly, one cannot experience emotions. And we're talking about elevated emotions, spiritual emotions. So here what Krishna is saying, what Rupa Goswami explains is, that we all want to experience spiritual emotions. And when we become purified, when we attain Krishna, at that time, we can all experience spiritual emotions. But what do we do while we are going towards purification? So he says, at that time, we can do sadhana bhakti, which invokes spiritual rasa in us. So we expose ourselves to as many spiritually evocative stimuli as possible. That means, we are talking about Uddipan here. Uddipan, if you see Bhaktivinoda Thakur in some of his songs, he uses the word Uddipan. And he talks about how the Yamuna, for example, is a Uddipan. So for Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he would see any river, it would appear to be like Kepa. So what is happening? The river is stimulating spiritual remembrance. Is stimulating remembrance of Krishna. In the world that we live today, we have a lot of materialistic uddipan. There are so many stimuli all around us that they stimulate material desires and material emotions very strongly. But the whole process of bhakti is to kindle spiritual uddipan within us. So there is, Rupa Goswami talks about Raganuga Bhakti and Ragatmika Bhakti. So Ragatmika Bhakti is the kind of bhakti that is practiced by the elevated devotees. Raga is attachment to Krishna. That is Atmika. It is present in their Atma itself. So for them, it is a natural emotion that is there. But for us, we can be Raganuga. So Anuga means we follow those who are having Raga. So where the advanced devotees will experience spiritual emotions spontaneously, we can experience spiritual emotion through conscious cultivation. Rupa Goswami's definition of bhakti is what? Shilanam, anushilanam. Shilanam, Prabhupada translates as cultivation. Jiva Goswami in the Durgam Sangamayitika on the Bhakti Sambha Sindhu, he explains that anushilanam is a combination of cheshta and bhav. Cheshta is endeavor and bhav is emotion. Normally we think that when there is bhav, there is no cheshta required. Like people say, they talk about falling in love. People say, I fell in love with someone. It's like, you know, you fall into a ditch, so you fall in love.
It's an idea.
So the idea is there that their emotion is something which is automatically awakened. Now, yes, that sort of emotion may be awakened automatically between two people, but that emotion is hardly ever sustainable for a long time. Now, yes, people, there may be love at first sight, but what happens in the relationship will depend on what people do after many sights. So, the emotion may come spontaneously in some occasions. That is okay. But for that emotion to be sustainable, there has to be conscious effort. Any relationship, if it has to be sustained, there may be initial attraction, there may not be initial attraction. But if the relationship has to be sustained, there has to be conscious effort. So now, for the difference between the relationship which we form with others in this world and the relationship we form with Krishna is that the soul has a natural attraction for Krishna. And as the soul becomes purified, the relationship with Krishna will become more and more active and strong. But it requires cultivation. Anushilanam means cheshta and bhava. So we strive to do those activities which stimulate spiritual emotion in us. So for example, we study the Srimad Bhagavatam, we chant the holy names. In all these, Krishna is manifesting as the holy name, as the Bhagavatam, as the deities. When Krishna manifests us, we, what is our cheshta? To expose ourselves to these stimuli as much as possible. And not just expose ourselves, also that exposure has to be with bhava. We may not have a lot of bhava right now, but whatever bhava we have, whatever emotion we have, we try to invest that in the devotional activity that we are doing. And when we do this, then by that, so there is a little microscopic bhava that will be there. But with the bhava, if we do cheshta, that is anushilanam. And by that anushilanam, that bhava will grow. Krishna says, atha chintam samadhatu na shaknosi mai sthiram abhyasa yogena tato ma icchaptum dhananjaya. So he says in 12.9 that if you cannot spontaneously fix your mind on me, then practice sadhana bhakti. That is abhyasa yoga. And by that, what will happen? He doesn't say you will attain me. That is a much advanced sense. He says you will attain desire for me. Ma icchaptum dhananjaya. And once we get the desire for Krishna, as Rupa Goswami says, tatra laulyam api maulyamekam. If you have a strong desire for Krishna, you will attain Krishna also. So we have, whatever little emotion we have, we invest that in the practice of sadhana bhakti, and by that, our emotion grows stronger. So now, with this thought framework, what does Rupa Goswami do? Let's see how he looks at Srimad Bhagavatam. So, the Srimad Bhagavatam uses the word rasa on several occasions, like the two words we discussed today itself, rasamalayam. And words, one of the characteristics of words is that their meanings don't stay static throughout history. The meanings of words keep changing. And because of that, for example, we have the Mimamsaka Sutra. It begins just like we have the Vedanta Sutra. So we have the Mimamsaka Sutra. Mimamsaka Sutra begins with Athato Dharma Jignyasa. So we ask, now let us know what is dharma. But now if you look at the Mimamsaka Sutra of Gemini, we'll find that his definition of dharma is very different from the definition of dharma that we get in the Bhakti tradition. His idea of dharma is primarily those ritualistic activities that take people towards him. Because Mimamsa, that is primarily the Karma Mimamsa focused on doing duties by which one will attain heaven. So, his idea of dharma is the specific code of conduct which will elevate one to heaven. There is not much talk about liberation or even much talk about grace. It just talk about beautiful execution of prescribed code of conduct. That's his conception of dharma. So, like that, the definition of rasa that is there at different times will be different. So, the Bhagavatam, when it talks about rasa, you see, the word rasa, most of us, we had probably heard about it before we came to Krishna consciousness as Amras and Gannaras.
It was the bread, the juice that we drink nicely.
That's all that the idea of rasa was there. But the Bhagavatam, when it talks about rasa, it is referring primarily to taste. Rasamalayam is filled with taste, filled with juice, filled with nectar. So drink that nectar. So the way the Bhagavatam, if you see the Bhagavatam, does not use any of the terminology of Nanda Shastra. It talks about the concept of rasa, but it does not use it. In the Bhagavatam, you don't find anubhava, vichari bhava, vibhava, arkare, karana, sahakari. These are two different traditions. So the Bhakti tradition, of which Bhagavatam is a prominent book, and then the rasa tradition, of which Natya Shastra was a defining book. Now, what Rupa Goswami did was, he brought about marriage of both. And how he did that is, taking the structure of the Rasa Shastra and the content from the Bhagavata. The structure from Natya Shastra and content from Bhagavata. And that way, he presented the Bhagavatam to his audience. That was the people of his times, who were very much enamored by the concept of Rasashastra. So, now when I'm saying that, Rupa Goswami presented this, what exactly do we mean by this? See, the emotion in the heart, when we are attracted to Krishna, when we are attracted to not only Krishna, any form of God, that emotion is an eternal reality. That emotion was there. If you look at, there's a whole different seminar I have, I talk about how the concept of, the definition of bhakti, which is say given by Ramanujacharya, the definition of bhakti given by Madhvacharya, the definition of bhakti given by Vallabhacharya, the definition of bhakti given by Nimbarka Swami, and then the definition of bhakti given by Rupa Goswami. How these definitions of bhakti are evolving, and how Rupa Goswami gives the highest definition of bhakti. For example, Ramanujacharya talks about bhakti is dhruvana smriti. It's constant deep remembrance of Krishna, of the Lord. That is what bhakti says. Madhvacharya says bhakti is a remembrance of the Lord with reverence. So like that, there are different acharyas. I'm just talking, mentioning it briefly over here. But the point is that bhakti as the attraction of the heart towards the Lord is an eternal experience that any soul who is attracted to the Lord will have. But presenting that experience in terms of rasa, in terms of rasa theory, was what Rupa Goswami did. So, just like one of our devotee scholars, he wanted to present, he was in an academic conference, he wanted to present the concept of Radha and Krishna. So now you go to academic conferences, you know, you have to use very, just say, oh, Radha and Krishna are God and his consort. Now people are like, what is this? So he says, so he wrote this paper, Radha and Krishna embody the primordial masculine cosmological principle and feminine cosmological principle.
What is that?
So primordial masculine cosmological principle.
Wow.
Something interesting. So now God as the absolute truth exists eternally. But this particular terminology used to explain God is something which will vary according to context.
So like that, the experience of the heart's love for Krishna, that is an eternal experience. But presenting it in terms of rasa theory was what Rupa Goswami did. So now, we are not going to focus on understanding rasa theory, because that itself is a whole subject. And it is not so relevant now, because for most of you, and for me also just some time ago, the whole idea of rasa was quite vague. So today, the rasa theory is not very popular. So if we try to present bhakti according to rasa theory, it's like we are piling unfamiliar upon unfamiliar. Bhakti itself is not very familiar to people, and then you present further. So it just doesn't make any sense to people. So the whole need for a living tradition, the whole need for a living tradition is that the living tradition has to present the eternal message in contemporary terms. In contemporary terms. So we have Srila Prabhupada's example when he was among the hippies. They asked him that, one hippie asked him, Prabhupada, what is Vaikuntha like? So Prabhupada said, what did he say? It's like an ocean of LSD. If somebody goes, well, in Shastra is it said that Vaikuntha is like ocean of LSD? Nowhere is it said like that. Then how is Prabhupada presenting something like this? See, there is, the point of teaching is not just to get it right. It is also to get it across. To get it right means I may speak everything. For example, you know, if somebody is a Sanskrit scholar and that person gives a class in perfect Sanskrit and nobody in the audience understands Sanskrit. You got it all right and you got it all wrong. You got it all right in terms of speaking Sanskrit, but nobody understood it. So what is the point of it? So the point is not just to get it right. The point is to get it across. Get it across means we have to make sure that people understand what is being spoken. So that's why we have Shri Prabhupada. Natat bhasayate suryo na shashanko na pavaka yad gatvan nivartante tad dham paramam mama. So Krishna is saying that that abode is not illumined by sun, moon or fire. And Prabhupada, that is electricity over there. Now where did electricity come from? Now some of us may say that, oh, then somewhere in some Upanishad, some Vidyuta is there. Okay, even if Vidyuta is there, that concept might be there. It's not there yet in the Bhagavad Gita. So what is Prabhupada doing over here? If we look at the verse, its main point is that the world, that the spiritual world, does not require any external source of luminosity. This is 15.6, and Krishna contrasts the spiritual world in 15.12 with the material world, where it says, Yada aditya kratam tejo jagat bhasita kila chandrama siyachalam tat tejo vidyamanakam. So here uses the same three things, the sun, moon and fire. These three illumine this world. So the point of this verse is that the spiritual world is self-luminous, and in that way it is different from the material world, which depends on the external source of luminosity. When Prabhupada is speaking to his audiences, now much of his audience, for them the primary source of luminosity is electricity. Now in an urbanized setting, we often live so much in artificial lighting that the primary source of, when we say light has gone, that means we think not the sun has set, we think of power has gone off. That's what we normally think of. So to communicate the point that scripture, that the spiritual world is self-luminous, it does not require external source of luminosity. That, what's Prabhupada doing? Prabhupada is saying over there that electricity. So when there is translation, if the translation is to be a commentary or explanation, if it is to be a living commentary, a living explanation, then it has to be presented in terms that are contemporarily intelligible for them. If we are not contemporarily intelligible, that's what actually, how did Buddhism and Jainism spread so much in India? Because at that time the Brahmins were very proud. You know, we are learned and we have the Vedas and it's present in Sanskrit. And most people couldn't understand Sanskrit. And when Buddhism and Jainism started presenting themselves in the vernacular languages, in Pali and Prakrit, the Brahmins didn't care really. That's a low-class language, who bothers about it? Yes, you may say that low-class languages, but that is what people are talking in. And so the Brahmins were presenting, they were expounding on the Vedas in Sanskrit and nobody was hearing. And Buddhists and Jainist thinkers were presenting vernacular languages and people were hearing. And people got transformed. So, this is an example of language. Here we see Prabhupada's pragmatism, that Prabhupada presented in English. Because English was, for whatever reason, the language which the world is using largely. So, he presented in English, and that's how his message had such enormous reach. So, presenting either in a contemporary language or contemporary thought process. So, at that time, what is Rupa Goswami's resourcefulness? Is that he took the message of bhakti and he presented it in terms of rasa shastra, and in that way he made that message appealing for his audience. So we don't have to understand the rasa shastra in detail, but what we need to understand is the principle underlying it. The principle underlying it is the awakening of refined emotions. The awakening. So what rasa is used over here is that the word rasa, as Rupa Goswami uses in Bhaktivedanta Sindhu, is that the emotion that is experienced in connection with the Lord when certain stimuli are provided and certain actions are done. So there is karya, karana, sahakari. So for example, now when we do kirtan, when Prabhupada went to the west and there in Lower East Side, there actually speaking, that was such an utterly anti-devotional environment. It is difficult to imagine a greater cultural mismatch than what was there between Prabhupada and his followers. You know, yes, his followers. Prabhupada was a person who was a born Vaishnava, cultured person, who was now a sannyasi, who had lived a pure life, never drank even tea in his life. And here there were young people for whom the regulative principle of their life was to break all regulative principles. They lived for drugs and they lived for sex. And there was, in fact, LSD, which was the drug. The one good thing about the LSD, it is a chemical. But these people, they had an idea that this drug will take us spiritual. So they had re-Christianed LSD as the League of Spiritual Discovery.
So,
those who are taking LSD, we have all joined the League of Spiritual Discovery. And we are going to discover spiritual truth. So the idea was that, if anybody takes LSD, then after that if a person starts speaking something, he's getting revelation from the God of LSD. So please go down and hear what he has to say. So you had to, actually if somebody goes into LSD hallucination and starts speaking, the whole culture was to respect that person. What is he speaking? What jewels of truth are going to fall out of his lips? So it is Prabhupada went in that culture. And it is a huge cultural mismatch. But within that cultural mismatch, what was it that linked? What is it that linked them all together? What is it that linked Srila Prabhupada and his disciples together? That was the call of spiritual love. That was the call of spiritual love that was manifested through the holy names. Now all of us, we have many cultural dissimilarities. We may be males, we may be females, we may be Indians, we may be non-Indians, we may be South Indians, North Indians. All kinds of external cultural differences are there. But underlying it is the heart. And the heart longs for lasting love. And the longing of the heart for lasting love can be fulfilled when the heart comes in contact with the supreme object of lasting love. That is Krishna. So Srila Prabhupada's Prabhupada's potency over there was that he, by the power of the holy name, by the power of the spiritual love which he injected the holy name into the hearts of his listeners, it cut across all boundaries and he interacted their hearts. So that is the universality of the message of bhakti. And I just, a few months ago, I was in Australia, so I had met Devamrita Maharaj there. So he was telling me that, there's one devotee who's trying to write a biography of Devamrita Maharaj. And I was telling that, Maharaj, you're very wonderful. You are a trans-world renunciate. You are African-American, you are educated in Yale, preached in Soviet Russia, and now you are based in Australia.
So this whole globe you have spanned. Literally a book of global interest.
So, Maharaj, I asked Maharaj how he started preaching in Australia. So Maharaj said that I came to Australia and he said they had a restaurant over there. I would just go and sit in the restaurant and whoever come to the restaurant, I would just let them talk and I will hear. What Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did with Sarva Bhattacharya. 7 days let him speak.
And after letting them speak for 7 days, what happened is
that these people became, this person hears me, these people go
little open-minded, little soft-hearted,
and then after that, he would speak.
That when he would speak, the people would hear.
So he said that the main thing you understand when you people speak is how little they understand. So this is no disrespect to any country's citizens. This is the level of people everywhere in Kalyuga. So the point is that he said that actually speaking, when we communicate intellectually to people, people have so many conceptual barriers. I met some of the Australian devotees there. So there, Bhaktivinoda Maharaj has a special way of preaching where they do not go at all in any devotional garb. They just appear entirely as secular people and they preach. So there was, I had a meeting with many of those devotees. So one Mataji was saying that if I had seen someone who would put clay on their head, I would never have joined such a cult. Now they are coming from a culture where the idea of tilak is completely incomprehensible for them. Utterly incomprehensible. It doesn't make any sense. You are putting clay. Who are the kind of people? There are some tribal native Australians or red Indians. They used to put clay on their head. So, who wants to join a primitive group like that? So, then what was it that attracted them? Yes, intellectually we can present our wisdom, that is good. But ultimately, whatever intellectual differences are there, whatever cultural differences are there, whatever racial, gender differences are there, beyond it all is the heart that longs for love. And the whole point of Bhakti Rasa is that it evokes the heart. And as long as the heart is not evoked, till that time, the person may get some attraction, may have some understanding. But that as long as the rasa is not evoked, as long as the heart is not attracted, there will not be any sustainable transformation. So what Srila Prabhupada was able to do was that he, if we see many of Srila Prabhupada's disciples, they might not be, at least in the initial stages, they might not be very learned in philosophy. But Prabhupada had infused Bhakti Rasa into their hearts by his personal purity, by his potency, and by his sharing Krishna and the holy name with them. And because that Bhakti Rasa was evoked, so when Gurudas was writing this book, Swamiji, I was helping in editing that book. So he said that what was the situation for us? So like Krishna could play the flute and Sarva Dharma Antaritya, the gopis, give up everything else and go towards Krishna. So like that, if Prabhupada told us do this, Prabhupada told us go to Pakistan. Now go to Pakistan. We will think 10 times you can go to Pakistan. You know, it will become Yadgatwana Nivartan.
So,
we will think like that. But Prabhupada told us go to Pakistan and the devotees risk their life.
No, it's one thing to go to Pakistan. Even now, if devotees will go, we will go in secular dress and conceal our devotional identity.
It's quite another thing to go to Pakistan and do public Harinam Sankirtan in the streets of Pakistan. That's what the devotees did. We might call that as reckless now, and we might not do it now, but it's fine. The point is that they were able to do that because they were so spiritually captivated.
So, the potency of rasa that is experienced in the process of bhakti is so great that it completely transforms the life of a person. Now we, have we experienced rasa at all? If we had not experienced any rasa at all, then we would not be practicing bhakti. I will conclude with this point, that can we experience Krishna's love at our stage in life? Our consciousness is gradually awakening right now. See, a mother has a small baby and the baby is lying on the bed sleeping and suddenly the atmosphere becomes cold and the baby starts shivering and the mother sees that the baby is shivering and the mother takes a rug and puts it carefully around the baby. Now the baby, especially the baby is newborn or just a few months, it doesn't understand much. It may drink milk from the mother's breast. But the baby doesn't even understand, oh, there is a mother and there is milk coming, there is a mother who is loves me and is giving me milk. Just drinks milk from the breast over there. I'm getting food, that's all. So, especially a newborn baby is fully in Annamaya Kosha. Everything is potential food. So, it'll take its finger and put it in the mouth, it'll take its leg and put it in the mouth. Whatever objects it gets, it parichaya, the introduction to the world happens to the tongue.
So, that is Annamaya Kosha.
Now at that stage, the consciousness is so primitive that is so, not primitive in a derogatory sense, it's an underdeveloped sense, that the baby will not understand at that time that there is my mother and my mother has put this blanket on my body. But what the baby will know is that I was feeling uncomfortable earlier and now I am feeling comfortable. I was cold and now I'm feeling warm. So that warmth, from where it is coming, the baby doesn't understand. But there is the warmth that is experienced. So similarly, we are like in a state of spiritual infancy. And at this stage, we don't really see Krishna coming, we don't see Krishna present in our heart. We may not have that kind of spiritual experiences. But we can, at our level, experience relief and shelter
in the remembrance of Krishna. We all have this experience at some time or the other, that, you know, we may be agitated, either agitated because of some problems and anxieties or agitated because of some too strong desires. And then we come to the temple and just take darshan, feel relief. It's a nice kirtan is going on and we feel relief. We start reciting some verses, studying some scripture, we feel relief. Now, we may not feel that the same kind of relief all the time in each of the activities. That will vary because depending on the modes that we are in, the extent of exposure to Krishna that is required to lift us up from a lower mode towards transcendence may vary. But the point is, all of us have had some experience like that. So, that experience of relief and shelter and strength that we get in the remembrance of Krishna, our experience is like that devi's experience of feeling relief when a blanket is put on. So it is, the experience is real, but our consciousness is not developed enough to make sense of the experience. That this shelter, this relief, this satisfaction that I'm experiencing, this, where is it coming from? So we understand, based on faith, based on faith in scripture, that at my level, this is the way I experience Krishna's love. We may not feel Krishna coming and embracing us. We may not feel any of the ways in which Krishna expresses love to his devotees in his pastimes. But the relief, the shelter, the satisfaction, the strength that we experience in the remembrance of Krishna, in absorption in Krishna, that is rasa experienced at our level. And when Prabhupada says, Yena Kena Prakara, Prabhupada quotes the scripture saying that Yena Kena Prakara Manam Krishna Niveshayet. Somehow or the other remember Krishna. What that means is that it is for us to take responsibility how we can best remember Krishna. Bhakti is not a stereotype activity. Some devotees may chant 64 rounds, some devotees chant 128 rounds on special days, some devotees may chant 192 rounds. Yes, if you want to chant more rounds and if you feel inspired by chanting, if you feel enlivened by chanting, that is wonderful. But different devotees may be enlivened in different ways. Now, if we are chanting 64 rounds and what we are doing essentially is counting. Now, when will the 64 rounds get over? And you're looking, you know, is this bead having 108 beads or 108, 1008 beads? Better remember Krishna in some other way. It's not that process of bhakti is not about torturing ourselves. The process of bhakti is about transcending ourselves. Our present conception of ourselves as the body, we want to transcend that. And there is a standard process of bhakti which we all follow. But beyond that, how we can be get attracted to Krishna, that is our responsibility. So what will act as a uddipan for me will be different from what will act as a uddipan for you. And what will act as a uddipan for you may be something different. So we can't mandate everything as a one-size-fits-all formula. Now, there is that room for individuality in bhakti. And we find out what is the uddipan for us. Some devotees will just singing some Vishnu songs. And even when we are singing songs, it is not that we have to memorize the whole song. Sometimes even one line of a song might trigger a scripture, might inspire us, and that's good enough. The important point is how I can connect my heart with Krishna. And that is where we are experiencing rasa. That is our uddipan. So, the way we can apply this whole rasa analysis, what the Bhagavatam does is, Bhagavatam offers us Krishna's pastimes. As I said, the largest part of the Bhagavatam is Krishna's pastimes. And through those Krishna's pastimes, they are the paradigm, they are the standard examples of ragatmika bhaktas. And what Rupa Goswami does is, he gives examples of those bhaktas to talk about how raganga bhakti can be practiced. So the characters in the Bhagavatam, they become models. And he recommended that we use them as models and apply them in our life to kindle remembrance of Krishna within us, to absorb ourselves in remembrance of Krishna. Now the specific way in which bhakti is to be practiced, that will vary according to time and circumstance. So the way, if we look at our Gaudiya tradition, the way bhakti sadhana was done till Bhaktivinoda Thakur, and the way bhakti sadhana was done after Bhaktivinoda Thakur, substantially different because the culture changed dramatically. The principle of connecting with Krishna remains the same. But that connection with Krishna will vary according to time, place, circumstances. Now, if somebody has a very rigid conception, for example, many of us, we hear the classes of our spiritual master through some recordings. Now, recordings were not there earlier. So, it is still Shravana. But it's a so there is Sambandha, Abhideya and Prayojana. Sambandha, Krishna, Abhideya, Bhakti, Prema, Prayojana. Bhakti, Chaitanya says this. So, in this, Sambandha and Prayojana, the object with which you form the relationship, that is Krishna, that remains unchanging. Prayojana, the goal of developing love for Krishna remains unchanging. But Abhideya, the process by which you will connect with Krishna, that is bound to change. Not change in the sense that we are going to put some other deity instead of Krishna, but change in the sense that the practical means by which you will connect with Krishna will be different. Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur in his books never put any pictures. Prabhupada in his books wanted pictures. Why is that? Because the standard of book publishing at the time of Bhaktisiddhanta Thakur was that religious books did not have pictures. But then there is what is that popular photography called? These simple pictures which came up, they are sold on the streets all the time. That sort of photography became very popular by the time Prabhupada was studying books. And all books had pictures. Was it include pictures? So, the Abhideya, how we connect with Krishna, that will vary according to time, place, circumstance. That will vary according to person to person. So, the practical application of Rasa theory for us is that there is higher emotion that is to be awakened. And there are Udipan which will awaken that higher emotion. And how that will be awakened will vary according to person to person. And when we recognize this and see what is it, what link of bhakti, what activity in bhakti, what service attracts me to Krishna the most. And as we take individual responsibility for linking our consciousness with Krishna, then by that we show Krishna our earnestness. And then we can move onwards towards Krishna's guiding. So I'll summarize. I started by talking about the process of bhakti. As is taught in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavatam is a conceptual evolution of Shukadeva Goswami, conceptual autobiography, from Dhimani to Rasamalayam. And then I talked about the Rasa tradition, I talked about Kari, Karan, Sahakari, how this was primarily in the field of drama, traditionally in India. But Rupa Goswami adapted it for the process of bhakti, and he presented bhakti in contemporary terms. And I talked elaborately about how that is the responsibility of the living tradition and the teachings of the tradition. How Prabhupada presented bhakti in contemporary terms. And then the practical application of this is in terms of Udipan for us. We find out what is it that stimulates rasa within us, stimulates higher emotion within our hearts. And we kindle that higher emotion in a way that we will be able to be propelled by emotions towards Krishna and not by our local emotions dragged away from Krishna. Thank you very much. Are there any one or two questions?